This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The man who gave America the idea that there could be such a thing as a media mogul is the focus of a new installment of the PBS anthology series American Experience. The story of William Randolph Hearst is told in the two-part, four-hour Citizen Hearst. One of the film's writers and directors joined me earlier to talk about it. Here is our recorded interview. Joining us now is Stephen Ives, the writer-director of the second episode of this two-part installment of American Experience titled Citizen Hearst. It premieres Monday and Tuesday, September 27 and 28 on PBS station. Stephen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be with you.
Well, it's always a pleasure to host the writers and directors of American Experience. I'm a bit of a fanboy for the series. This episode, because of its subject matter, being a historic media figure, was of particular interest to me. And I was wondering what your perspective is on this as I was watching him. I'm trying to figure out what William Randolph Hearst's influence on media that might be visible today.
Well, I think it's everywhere. I think he's like one of these, I think of him as one of those giant billboards in Times Square. You know, he is this tremendous force that transformed the American media landscape. Everything that we see in the flood of information, the explosion of stories, the celebrity-driven culture, the fake news that's all around us, those were all elements of a media empire that Hearst created and were, I think, his influence is sort of embedded in the DNA of American media today.
You know, watching the exploration of the different types of newspapers that were in these large American cities at the time that William Randolph Hearst was getting into this business, it struck me that even large cities don't have that number of physical newspapers anymore to drive that kind of competition and to find that specific niche within the population. But then I thought a little more about it and considered that it is sort of like that because of the explosion of online media content. And I'm wondering what we can draw specifically from some of those national outlets that have emerged exclusively online over the past decade plus, and how does it compare to some of the rivalries that William Randolph Hearst had with people like Joseph Pulitzer in New York?
Well, I think it's important to realize how influential newspapers were in Hearst's era. I mean, there just wasn't any other outlet for news at the beginning when he bought the San Francisco Examiner and then later when he bought the Journal in New York. And so they had tremendous reach. And at one point in the late 20s, one in four Americans picked up a Hearst newspaper every morning. And yes, the proliferation of online news is everywhere in our culture right now, but I think it's diffused and there's so much background noise. There's so much choice and diversity of opinion and crazy information out there on the web that it's not the same as what Hearst was able to do. He had an extraordinary amount of power and influence, more than members of the government often. And he could move the needle on national events, on local events, on the state level in a way that really was unprecedented. And even Rupert Murdoch and people like that, I don't think have quite the same level of power that Hearst did.
I mean, to just emphasize that point, the Spanish-American War was heavily influenced by Hearst's coverage.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he saw it as a good story. He loved melodrama. He loved to frame stories with good guys and bad guys, and he hated villains and he loved to go after them. And the Spaniards and their rape of Cuba, their last colonial possession, was a story perfect for his approach. And he saw an opportunity to build readership, to get more eyeballs, to boost his circulation, and in the process to get more power. And he didn't care really about the fallout from it. He just went after it, and he brought Joseph Pulitzer along in their competition with one another.
Interestingly, he's played both of those roles. He'd been a hero and he'd been a villain. And in the aftermath of the conclusion of the Spanish-American War, and that war had driven sales of the newspapers significantly, but this was a period in American history where these papers were distributed by newsboys, poor, often very poor young boys who stood out on the street trying to sell these newspapers. And just like business guys would purchase these papers wholesale. And so after the war, circulation declined significantly because people did not need that daily update of what was happening in the southern part of this hemisphere. And
right.
I'm wondering your perspective of how he handled this, because he was the villain in the famous Newsboys strike.
Yeah, they were called Newsies, and they were the poorest of the poor little street urchins who were scraping along. Often they were literally orphans, or they had been estranged from their parents and they could barely get enough to eat. And they were the ones, you see these great pictures of them, you know, in their little caps and their knickers. And they were out getting Hearst and Pulitzer's papers into the hands of their readers. And Pulitzer and Hearst thought they could just screw him over. And the little kids, led by a leader named Kid Blink, went on strike and fought these newspaper titans to a draw, basically, and forced the guys to capitulate. And it says a lot about Hearst's business philosophy, that he was willing to sort of crush the smallest possible members of the economic system in order to eke out a little bit more power and a little bit more profit. And it's not his most flattering moment, for sure.
It's even a bit of a contradiction, isn't it? Because after he had success in San Francisco with the Examiner, he entered the New York market with a competitive attitude and wanted his paper to go to the top there. But he did it by finding his audience in the working class people, did he not?
Yeah, he had an unerring sense of what the working class reader wanted to read. And he was really open to reaching out to all sorts of different ethnic communities within New York. And he was a crusader. You know, he went against Tammany Hall, the boss, the machine, political machine that ran New York and kept the ICE Trust and the gas trust in the hands of these plutocrats. And he really did make a difference in helping the lives of the working class immigrants, overwhelmingly immigrants who lived in New York at that time. But at the same time, he's not somebody who's gonna necessarily take a hit to his own bottom line. So there's a real contradiction in him. There's always a tension, and you wonder whether what Hearst is doing is out of some deep-seated philosophy of being a progressive, or whether it's simply a way to build his empire and build his readership. And that never gets fully resolved in his entire life.
We're talking with Stephen Ives, the writer and director of the second episode of the two-episode new installment of American Experience, Citizen Hearst. It explores the colorful life and times of William Randolph Hearst. It premieres Monday and Tuesday, September 27 and 28 on PBS stations. William Randolph Hearst was a student at Harvard, but not a very good one. He came from a wealthy background. His father was George Hearst, who made a fortune out west, ultimately served in the United States Senate. So he was born a child of serious, significant privilege. And these films explore that upbringing and how he didn't live in the dorms. For example, he had apartments while a student at Harvard, and also through lavish wild parties, was admitted to all of the exclusive organizations. But significantly there for the rest of his life is where he first, encountered how he could transform a newspaper. He became heavily involved with the Harvard Lampoon, which had always lost money, and he turned it into a profitable business. And one of the people featured in this installment of American Experience described Hearst as a born newspaper man. And he would go on to prove that. But what made him such?
It's an interesting question. I think he just had an unerring sense of what people wanted to read, and he had a visionary idea of how to market a newspaper and transform it. I mean, you just can't imagine how dull the front page of newspapers were back then. They were just columns and columns of type, and he invented and innovated with wild layouts, gigantic headlines, lurid subheads, the use of color, cartoons and comics, and he just brought the paper into alive. And he followed these melodramatic stories, often about crime or women being attacked or horrible fires, and he made people want to tune in to find out how these would play out. Sometimes they'd be serialized over the course of a week. And he just really worked like a dog on the layout. He was putting the edition to bed every night, sometimes dressed in his formal evening wear. And he'd be up in the newsroom at 2 a.m, making sure that the paper was exactly the way he wanted it to be the next morning. And that's why he was so successful.
When he was born a child of privilege, he did not end up with all of that money following the sudden passing of his father. That fortune went to his mother. Can you talk a bit about the relationship he had with his mother and particularly how it relates to his need to have some of these business ventures financed with her permission?
Yeah, it was a bitter pill for him. His father didn't leave him the money he thought he was going to get. He left it all to his mom. He was tethered to his mother as an adult. It was a kind of a humiliating situation. He'd have to go and beg for money to do things, to buy newspapers, to expand his empire. And at the same time, he was very close to Phoebe. He was a bit of a mama's boy. He said, when she died, he said, I guess I was always a bit of a mama's boy, and I'm very glad of it. So there's a complicated tension there. She never in the end denied him the big money. They were an easy relationship, and it was frustrating for him. And finally, when she dies of the flu, of the epidemic in 1919, interestingly enough, he is given the money and he is fully unleashed. And then is when he starts building San Simeon and kind of going really crazy in terms of expanding his empire at all costs.
I want to talk about San Simeon. This is featured in the second installment, which you wrote and directed of this installment of American Experience. He was royalty, basically, as American royalty can be, and he built himself a castle. What was his motivation to create such a grand estate?
He was royalty in a way, but remember, he was always an outsider. He came from California. He didn't blend into New York society. He didn't care about the aristocracy that he saw in America. And San Simeon is this expression, I think, of Hearst's deeply American confidence, his optimism, his bold, kind of carnivorous acquisition of things, his desire to control and own things. And he builds this castle that, as David Nassau, our biographer, says, only a madman would have built a castle up on the hills that far out in the middle of nowhere. But he had a castle's worth of treasures in which to fill it. And he created a fantasy world that was almost a reflection of this oversized, extraordinary persona that would cast a shadow across the American media landscape for decades.
And this second installment does explore the new competing media, the movie business, and we also get to see a bit of his relationship with the changing economy in the country upon the arrival of the Depression and how he was first supportive of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and then, like a lot of wealthy people, turned his opposition towards some of those New Deal policies. It's a fascinating installment of American Experience, two-part. I've got about a minute left, Stephen, and I'm wondering why you thought Hearst's story needed 4 hours, four really gripping, entertaining hours.
Well, because he's such a huge figure, really, in the American landscape. He had a tremendous career starting as a very young man and was still powerful and influential, you know, in the 50s. And so I think he felt like a character that needed to be really excavated and understood in light of the kind of hyper corporate, hyper diversified media landscape that we live in today. And I think that to understand how we digest information in this country, how much power resides in the control of that information, what a cautionary tale the control of that information can be, are all things that in some ways circle back to the story of William Randolph Hearst. And that's why we felt it was so important to do it and to do it at the length that we felt it deserved.
It was very well done. I enjoyed it immensely and hope a lot of people check out American Experience, Citizen Hearst, a two-part installment of American Experience, premiering Monday and Tuesday, September 27 and 28 on PBS stations. Our guest has been Stephen Ives, a writer-director of one of the episodes. The other episode was directed by Amanda Pollock and written by Gene Tempest, who also served as producers on this project. Stephen, thank you so much for the time you gave us. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you, Michael. I really enjoyed talking to you.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.